Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects, is a place where I hope we attract thoughtful conversation and thoughtful men. Contemplative Masons would be the most a welcome crowd, but anybody out there who happens to be tuning in today, it's a pleasure. I think we have an interesting commentary today. It's some unusual times that we're in. Always unusual times. This is the birthday of William Shakespeare, none other. Yeah, I am not always sure if Shakespeare was had the same effect on all languages, all peoples, as he has had on English. And delightfully, it was. He has some controversy that swirls around him, which I think is almost necessary. He was a dramatist, and he helped to bring about the definitions of emotion, states of mind. That was new and ever so exciting. We've just passed the time when another great mind was born, April 22nd, Immanuel Kant. And his work, he's born in Russia. And he was publishing science papers, and he included the General Natural History and Theory of the Heavens in 1755, if you can believe that. So right after that, he spent 15 years as a metaphysics lecturer, and he published the first of part of Critique of Pure Reason. I won't bore you with the details here, but he's an interesting read, obviously, a person whose ideas have endured. One of the things about Kant that we can pick up just in passing is that he liked structure. I think I'll say that and go out on a bit of a limb. I'm not always sure if that's at the expense of the fluidity necessary to make connections and understand the world around us. But we're certainly grateful for everything that Immanuel Kant said and did. We're going to have, I think, a worthwhile episode, a commentary for you today, and some inspired music. We have things to do and people to see. One of the first things I want to do today is talk to you about a person, and I want to sponsor him, and I'd like your support in that regard, and I'll tell you about who this person is in a moment. We have this is a person that is a poet. He's was born in England again, and he wrote such love poems as this idea of a love poem entitled Funeral Blues. Yeah. He was born in 1907, and he died in 1973 in Vienna. If you can Imagine not that long ago. As he said, this is W.H. Auden. Among those who I like or admire, I can find no common denominator. But among those who I love, I can. All of them make me laugh. We are all here on earth to help each other. We are all here on earth to help others. What on earth the others are here for, I don't know. And I think this quote speaks to the heart of Masons. Evil is unspectacular and always human, and shares our bed and eats at our own table. It's not the lines of a simple-minded man, but nevertheless quite profound. Eh? I will be quoting some of his work later today. I'm just set the tone. But what I like most about Auden and why I want to sponsor him, you might ask. A poet is, before anything else, a person who is passionately in love with language. Here's what I love about him. This is written about him in the New York Review of Books, called The Secret Auden. I'll just read a little piece of this. This is, it was an article from 2014. Auden, W.H. Auden, had a secret life that his closest friends knew little or nothing about. I like to think that he shared his secret with many of you, many of the listeners. Everything about the secret was generous and honorable. He kept it secret because he would have been ashamed to have been praised for it. I learned about it mostly by chance, so it may have been far more extensive than I or anyone else ever knew. Once at a party, I met a woman who belonged to the same Episcopal church that Auden attended in the 50s, St. Mark's in the Bowery in New York. She told me that Auden heard that an old woman in the congregation was suffering night terrors. So he took a blanket and slept in the hallway outside her apartment until she felt safe again. Someone else recalled that Auden had once been told that a friend needed a medical operation that he couldn't afford. Auden invited the friend to dinner. Never mentioned the operation. But as the friend was leaving, said, "I want you to have this," and handed him a large notebook containing the manuscript of The Age of Anxiety. The University of Texas bought the notebook, and the friend had the operation. From some found letters amongst Auden's papers, the writer learned that a few years after World War II, he had arranged through a European relief agency to pay the school and college costs of two war orphans chosen by the agency. An arrangement that continued later with new sets of orphans until his death at 66 in 1973. At times, he went out of his way to seem selfish while doing something selfless. When NBC television was producing a broadcast of The Magic Flute, for which Auden, together with Chester Coleman, had translated the libretto, he stormed into the producer's office, demanding to be paid immediately, instead of on the date specified in his contract. He waited there, making himself unpleasant, until a check finally arrived. A few weeks later, when the canceled check came back to NBC, someone noticed that he had endorsed it. Pay to the order of Dorothy Day. The New York City Fire Department had recently ordered Day to make costly repairs to the homeless shelter she managed for the Catholic worker movement, and the shelter would have been shut down had she failed to come up with the money. At literary gatherings, he made a practice of slipping away from the gaunt and great, the famed for conversation, as he called him in a poem, to find the least important person in the room. A letter writer in the Times of London last year recalled one such incident. 60 years ago, my English teacher brought me to London from my provincial grammar school for a literary conference. Understandably, she abandoned me for her friends when we arrived, and I was left to flounder. I was gauche and inept and had no idea what to do with myself. Auden must have sensed this because he approached me and said, "Everyone here is just as nervous as you are, but they're bluffing, and you must learn to bluff too." Late in life, Auden's self-revealing poems and essays had portrayed him as an insular and nostalgic, still living imaginatively in the Edwardian world of his childhood. Quote, doggerel by a senior citizen, quote, began, "Our Earth in 1969 is not the planet I call mine," and continue with disgruntled complaints about the modern age. "I cannot settle which is worse, the anti-novel or free verse." A year after he wrote this, I chanced to see a first book by a young poet, N.J. Loftus, Exiles and Voyages. Some of the book was in free verse, much of it alluded to Harlem and Africa. The author's ethnic loyalties were signaled by the name of the publisher, the Black Market Press. And the book was dedicated to my first friend, W.H. Auden. So, brethren, do you see why I like your support in sponsoring this man as a Mason? Bring it home to this part of the world. A few years ago, the writer had a phone call from a Canadian burglar who told me he had come across Auden's poems in a prison library and had begun a long correspondence with Auden, which Auden gave him an informal course in literature. Auden was especially pleased to get him started on Kafka. He was equally helpful to unknown young poets who sent him their poems, offering detailed help on such technical matters as adjectives and enjambment. And when he felt obliged to stand on principle on some literary or moral issue, he did so without calling attention to himself. And he was impatient with writers like Robert Lowell, whose political interests seemed to be, to him, more egocentric than effective. When he won the National Medal of Literature in 1967, he was unwilling either to accept it in Lyndon Johnson's White House during the Vietnam War or to make a Cal Lowell gesture by a public refusal. So he arranged for the ceremony to be held in the Smithsonian, where he gave an acceptance speech about the corruption of language by politics and propaganda. He was always professional in his dealings with editors and publishers, uncomplainingly rewriting whole essays when asked, except on at least two occasions when he quietly sacrificed money and fame rather than falsify his beliefs. In 1964, for his translation of Dag Hammarskjöld's posthumous Markings, he wrote a foreword that mentioned Hammarskjöld's narcissistic fascination with himself and alluded almost invisibly to Hammarskjöld's homosexuality, which Auden perceived as something entirely inward to Hammarskjöld and never acted upon. A thorn in the flesh which convinces him he can never hope to experience what for most people are the two greatest joys earthly life has to offer, either a passionate devotion returned or a lifelong happy marriage. 2 years later, Life magazine offered him $10,000 for an essay on the fall of Rome, and the last of a series of multiple authors titled The Romans. Auden's typescript ended with his reflections on the fall of the two empires. This is all I'll say. I think a great many of us are haunted by the feeling that our society, or by ours, I don't mean just the United States or Europe, but our worldwide technological civilization, either officially labeled capitalist, socialist, or communist, is going to go smash and probably deserves to. Brethren, ladies and gentlemen, I think W.H. Auden is a man of considerable character. I plead to you to consider the merits of this man. He stands in for principle. He has a sense of his own purpose in mind. Some of his acts are truly inspiring, and those are the types of things that inspire and bring out the best in the likes of me and, I hope, all of you. So, I put before you W.H. Auden. And to give you a moment to reflect, here's Bill Evans, Time Remembered. This is an unusual piece. This is his trio with a full symphony orchestra. See what you think. Thank you. This is one of those beautiful pieces of music by Bill Evans. It's just hard to get out from your memory. I'm just sitting here as I was listening to that, going through a piece of work written by Henry Robertson. I'm sure some of you will be claiming to remember Henry Robinson. He was his article was written in April 1881. And what the fellow did was, he wrote the first compilation of Canadian Masonic law, and he dedicated it by the author. And this was he did this in 1889. Anyway, I'm certainly going to share this in the open air, this material. But what comes to me, he talks about bylaws and absences in a very genteel way. But the strength and purpose of what he writes is about tells me that Masonry has evolved considerably, and I would dare say that in some circles this could be referred to as innovation, except perhaps innovation has a more deliberate and purposeful sense for most of us. What Henry did. Henry was practiced law so very long ago, and unless you pick up this kind of material, you may never know of him. It's the kind of person I kind of like. It's the kind of person that strikes me as what I was hoping to be to find as inspiration as a Mason. And coincidentally, I looked and there they were. He's inspiring or not, what Robinson is talking about, it defines Masonry almost like a Henry Moore sculpture. Now, Henry Moore was really helped us to understand that part of the work isn't always the stone that's there, but what's not there, the space, the that is defined, and when you start to think about it, originally I really didn't like Henry Moore's work because I didn't understand it. It was very confusing. I was all riven by my amygdala. I couldn't tell if this was something that I liked or something that I didn't. So I relied very heavily. That triggered off my limbic portion of my brain, and I just reacted emotionally to it. We can all pay attention to that kind of a notion of brain function, brethren, around the world. It's a human condition. And one of the things that Masonry asks us to consider is to get control of our emotion. Well, we control our emotion. When our brain is most active, is active, and we have control, the prefrontal cortex is very active. It's where we're making decisions, evaluation. And when we're driven by our emotion, that raw primitive limbic area of the brain, the cortex activity diminishes considerably. So if you're wondering, is there some fact that supports this loose notion of human psychology or psychiatry? Well, yeah. And we've known this for quite some time. But for those who are, you know, we don't necessarily have to be slaves to a fact-based environment or world around us, but we do need to pay careful attention to it. It's the science that helps us to be determined, I think. What the determination of Henry Robertson, I think, is helping us to define the work and the thinking of past grandmasters up to that period. And if you think about it, if you are in an organization where there is a driven by policy and rules, what does it tell you about the organization? Well, it tells us that it's not an organization that necessarily, at first blush here, it's not an organization that necessarily encourages innovation. Now, that's kind of interesting, don't you think? That we would have carefully worded policies. The care that's taken in the development of policy and rules and the Masonic laws instill a sense of clarity and precision. Not that we live according to a rule book, or we would be kind of a tragedy, because we'd have to pull out the rule book on life and love and the satisfaction of good friends around us. Well, there's not really a rule book for that, is there? Is there, brethren? It's perhaps the good fortune of a life well lived. But what we're learning here about the order is that, and that you've heard me praise the benefits of having a clear constitution to free us. It eliminates so many boundaries. It's not handcuffing us, or as one rather unpleasant, ill-mannered Mason referred to many years ago as the production line. Simple-minded fellow that he was. It would be like, I think for me, it compared a birthing unit in a hospital as a production line. There's mothers having babies, producing life and lives that are going on to hopefully live balanced and successful, whatever that is, but also people who will struggle and hopefully will learn and adapt and have the resources and be innovative enough to prevail. Never to accept their lot in life, always to prevail, to develop. That too is part of Masonic philosophy. Is there a rule that compels you? Well, there is in a way. You knelt at an altar and took obligations. My goodness. That part of the rule, that part of the Constitution, that part of Masonry operates within your fabric. And you and I know that. But we can't go around chastising ourselves constantly. That's ridiculous. Or having that a sense of insincerity. I know more about the precision of policies and rules, therefore I'm more superior in some way. Nah, it's only useful when you need it. It's only useful when you need it. And if policies and rules are translated or exercised with the kind of fairness and thoughtfulness and generosity toward our brethren and everyone else around us, then they would not grate on our nerves. They would never cause us to chafe. They would never be offered in a muscular, overstated, intemperate manner. There's no need to raise our voice about this, unless you can't control your emotion. Does rank give us the right to do that? Well, as W.H. Auden pointed out to the young student in the room, the rich and famous and powerful were bluffing, and the rest of us have to bluff too. I'm big and muscular, or I'm old and no longer care about your reasoning, so pay attention to me. Please, don't insult those fellows. Don't ever tell them that they're laughable and they make themselves sound like fools. They would get quite, what, pouty? So I'm grateful for this. You guys, I don't know if you find this kind of material around the world. I know in each of, whether you're in Australia or in France or Denmark or Norway or wherever you happen to be, or where are we picking up some interest in Hungary? Yeah, if you're you find the old writings, pick up what you take from them literally, but then think about what is shaped, as Michelangelo would say, you know, you take away the part of the stone that doesn't belong, and there you have this beautiful sculpture. We'll do the same with this. Take away, this removes some things, but what does it leave behind? What shape does it leave behind in your mind? Are you all pouty and feeling that it's restrictive or that it's ridiculous? Well, okay. But enlist the part of your mind that where reason is included. If this had solely been, I put this to you, gentlemen, ladies, if masonry had been solely based on rules and regulations, it would never have existed. Masonry developed and exists groups between groups of people all over the face of the earth. Uncannily, I think, and this is my limit, is that it seems to have happened almost by caprice, you know, serendipitously at different points about the same time. Now, how? I like to think it's to do with the kind of intellectual and emotional climate of that period, 14th, 15th, 16th century. We had great minds, very active great minds, not the politics that we have today. And this is not to speak derisively about what's going on today. Let's certainly get over that sentimental notion that everything before was simpler and better. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. Oh, good grief. You know, people would die from an abscess too. They still can today, but it's a lot harder. Thank goodness we have the wherewithal to vaccinate our kids, our children, and against mumps and measles, and where we get a little bit daffy about stuff like that, well, we have death rates around the world again, don't we? Oh, better that we prevail, that we have to. Then there's things going on with enormous questions and problems where we do not have simple answers. And if we ever become so arrogant as to set aside another nation's history and to ignore another culture's way of developing, to impose our own thinking, well, that's the day when we should close the doors and lock, put a lock on them and throw away the key. We are what we are, and we aspire to more in ways that are hard to define. Hard to define. Robertson's material is beautifully written. Look, it says here, it would appear quite as impossible to say that a district deputy grandmaster could be deprived of his official powers as that he could be deprived of the rights of membership. He may not exercise his official powers unless he chooses to do so, but he may keep them in abeyance. But if the occasion arises, the powers are there and can be brought into action at pleasure. So when you have or given responsibility, sometimes masonry is the first time that a man has experienced responsibility. It's really self-discipline that he's becoming aware of. And I often equate the occasions as practicing. You remember when you were practicing shaving and you're practicing the use of colognes and aftershaves? And we would walk out of our house on a date with, what will we say, an aura that would be picked up on the slightest zephyr and carried for miles. An impenetrable barrier that no bug would attempt. All to impress that our lady love. You know what I mean? Yeah, we learned a little bit goes a long way, did we, gentlemen? Oh, let's slap on that aftershave. It's subtlety. Let's talk about the subtlety. We're not there. We don't have a 13 or subtlety. Well. So, Henry, thank you so very much, so very long ago, for teaching and bringing to our mind the subtlety of masonry that's always there. Unless you're a grumpy old narrow-minded a fellow who's lost in his reptilian mind. Oh my goodness, I'm going to be slaughtered by the creationists out there. Oh dear me. But we have we know so much more, and we can be gentle with ourselves about adapting and adjusting. Nobody's forcing you to do it. Nobody's forcing you to be intelligent or articulate or to develop your language skills or your reading skills. Nobody's forcing you. If you can't figure out that on your own, nobody's forcing you to develop a sense for the fine arts or to learn a little bit more about engineering or geometry or mathematics or physics. Nobody's there to force you anymore. You're a big boy. It's on you, but those are the things that are kind of fascinating. That's like, you know, why did Icarus want to fly up in the air? Well, that's, you know, oh my goodness, he flew too close to the sun. There's a lesson. Don't, you know, the wax will melt. But his dad was just telling him, like, that's all dads do. Just there's danger out there. But what did Icarus do? That's where the action was. The higher for those moments before he crashed, can you imagine the view? Just incredible. Wow. You with me? When you come back, we'll get into the commentary. It's a zinger. This is a bit of an oblique shout out to our Australian supporters here. It's one of Adelaide's best jazz singers. Her name's Sarah Lloyd. Beautiful, beautiful material. Check this out.
Now we are in the last of night. Far gone is the golden hour. The dark could never dim your eyes. Tiptoe through the streets and creep over the eaves and run across the roof and head like a thief will go until the stars expire. So here is where the culprit lies. We're pushing statues to the ground. And now we have the reckless kind. The crashing is the sweetest sound. We'll tiptoe through the streets and creep over the eaves and run across the roof and hide from the police. The hearts are picking pockets out. My darling, don't you turn back.
She's just beautiful voice. Beautiful. We're gifted to have this kind of talent around the world. Just phenomenal. To all you Celts and Vikings out there, and you spread around the world, you're a courageous bunch. often not necessarily because you wanted to. We're in the 120th day of the year. That only leaves us 245, as you knew. You knew that already. But here in this part of the world, we're 51 days from summer solstice. So 51 days from summer solstice. Yeah, not bad. It means that a winter solstice in the southern hemisphere is 51 days away as well. But here, we're only four days and 18 hours away from something called Beltane. This speaks speaking directly to all of you, to the Celts out there. Yeah, this is observed by Gaels, the modern Irish people, Scottish people, the Manx, and Celtic neo-pagans, and the Wiccans. It's the anglicized name for the Gaelic May Day festival, commonly held on Beltane. It's a springtime festival of optimism, during which fertility ritual again was important. Well, you think about it, at a time when we were stooped in our labors trying to grow enough food to support our livestock and our families. This is a pretty important period. And it was warm enough, the ground was warm enough in a lot of places of the world where to begin seeding and planting. And you wanted to have a successful crop, didn't you? So, boy, you took these days to celebrate. And this was pre-Christian and went back into pagan times. Paganism, that notion was something that was produced by a Christian movement. Back in the day, Christianity had gone through quite a period of buffeting against the shores. The form that we follow, that the world tends to know, was literally in competition with other messiahs historically. There were different messiahs claiming to be the way. And so it sounds a little bit glib, but how would you and I, what would we do if we had this strong belief in our particular version? You know, VHF or beta? We can't trivialize it. We would do what we could to improve the brand, bring the message to more people, and prevail. And the remarkable strength was the sense of self-sacrifice, sense of purpose. Then replace the notion of an eye for an eye with the notion of forgiveness. The hope for all humanity. So for all of the Wiccans and neo-pagans and Celts that are out there from all over the planet, wherever you've wandered, your genes are still oozing the Celtic beliefs. Celtic and Viking gene pools are still strong. So I wish you all a pre-happy May 1st Beltane. Do well with it and be inspired and celebrate it. And yes, you've brought optimism, a reason to celebrate something as remarkable as optimism to all of us. So thanks for that. Thanks for that. And get ready. We're coming up to, we only have 51 days left in the spring. 51 days, cram it in there. 51 days left to get to winter. Summer's coming here. Winter's heading southern hemisphere. Winter's, people are just still experiencing that this summer weather and that cyclical nature, that repeated and familiar nature of our existence. I have to ask you, though, to bear with me just a little bit. That we're sort of celebrating William Shakespeare. Yeah. If you're fortunate enough to have this part of your brain and mind still active, here, listen to this. This is from Twelfth Night by Fest. What is love? 'Tis not hereafter. Present mirth hath present laughter. What is to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty. Then come, kiss me, sweet and 20. Youth's the stuff will not endure. I'm, what, 67 now? He's right, you know. We're not boys anymore. He's telling us, what about love? It's not later on. Laughter comes the moment something's amusing. The future is always uncertain. And there's no profit in waiting around. So come and kiss me, my 20 times sweet one. We won't stay young forever. But think about the beauty of those memories. You know, I want all of us to have the calmness and balance of living in the moment. But this is one of the benefits of, you know, our past lives and exists in our imagination just as our future does. Well, so does our memory, our memories, things that we experienced. And the beauty of our mind is something that should inspire every one of us. Our mind over the years allows and enables us to refine and capture the beauty and the positive, the wonder of our past. It's more difficult to remember the grit and the uncommonness than the pleasure. Now, we know that a lot of men and women, a lot of people experience traumas. And now we have hope for them that we can extend. We know how to reach out, to refocus, help them to refocus, not to erase. That would be impertinent and disrespectful. But to reclaim some of the price that people have paid for their experiences, the unpleasant shock and horror. Some things don't need to be seen and re-witnessed. And you certainly don't heal to accomplish my pleasure. You do that for yourself. But you do have a place and you do belong. Just as the old soldiers around us often suffered in silence, managed the best way they could, but they did prevail. So, a little tip of the hat to the people that have put themselves in uniform and went out there, and regardless of the political motivation or the wit of the military leaders, they did the right thing. No question about it. Did the right thing. The reasons for that, well, we'll talk about that over a pint or a cup of tea. Here's the commentary for today. Are you comfy? Settled into your chair. Get your hand wrapped around something worth sipping on. Here I've got a nice espresso, and I've got a latte within eyesight waiting for me when the show's over. That wasn't either of them, by the way. Just having a little tickle in my throat. It's better now. This is entitled Echoes. Can you hear it? Whether obligations are taken seriously matters little. Masonry is an echo that began 14th, 15th century, a sound that began in the distance in different locations, but a sound nevertheless that harmonized indistinct from the winds. The sound was as lyrical and soothing as it was informative. Immanuel Kant knows that science is organized knowledge. Wisdom is organized life. Nature gave the listeners a sense of purpose and order. There was balance. Men facing the chaotic ethics of religion, of rule, of a time when natural law was emerging in the collective conscience, began to understand common purpose was a sanctuary. Common purpose was a sanctuary. Listeners are an obscure lot. Should say listeners like you. A small portion of all peoples. The sound echoes over savagery, pestilence, and starvation. Common purpose. As imperfect as is masonry, it rewrites the work of nature into symphonies. It has as many homes as there are sources of the wind, with the same restraints, flowing across borders over time, unending. Yeah. Trotum Jazz Orchestra, 2009. A little something from Norway for the world out there. Just groans. Not to like, gentlemen. That's not to like. Just absolutely fabulous music. Thank you, Norway, for your contribution. Free flow and exceptional six-string bass. The riffs just really quite remarkable. You see how it comes together in a jazz orchestra. Full marks. Absolutely full marks. You've We're going to wrap up the show a little bit today with a bit of inspiration, yeah? A little throw out to all of the soldiers out there. Vende, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. So, soldiers. I doubt that the foot soldiers were thinking that way, but the Romans did have a way of keeping people busy and focused and did accomplish great things. This is about, I want to talk to you just a little bit about winning and losing, if that's okay. I was going to get into a little bit about something called Coelia. It's a philosophical term of art for what we are directly aware of in consciousness. But I thought maybe we'll leave that for another day when we're all a little more alert. Coelia, Q-U-A-L. Go and check it out, Coelia. See the meaning. Explore the greatest challenge that's left to facing humanity, the human mind. Go and have a look at it. See what you can figure out before you gear up. And can you man up enough to face the greatest challenge of all? Just understand yourself. You've got a lot of help. Don't come whining and complaining, and don't be acting like you're a big tool. You're expected to have have some manners, a bit of poise, and some grace. Conduct yourself as a gentleman. Whatever you're doing, you know, all that means is taking account of how you come across to other people. Not whether you sit there and tell yourself that you're thoughtful. Nobody cares what you tell yourself. Sorry, it's the truth. All they want to know is all they know about you is how you act. Thoughtful person, then you act that way. In their assessors, not yours, in their assessment. Very few of Shakespeare's bested soldiers live to fight another day. In Shakespeare's world, people won, people lost. So we refer to refers to that notion, that theme, through as many of his works. You know, he saw me and yielded, that I may justly say, with the hook-nosed fellow of Rome, I came, I saw, and I overcame. That's how he referred to Vendivi Divici. And we use that on the occasion of bragging rights. Use it when you triumphed over your nemesis, and simply substitute for the first word he any subject that fits. For example, that driver's test saw me and yielded. Falstaff wasn't the only Shakespearean character with an affinity for Julius Caesar's famous three-part swagger. Rosalind quotes it in As You Like It, labeling it a thrushsonical brag. I love that, thrushsonical. The Wicked Queen in Cymbeline quotes the hook-nosed fellow's catchphrase as well, and the hippy-dippy Spanish poet Don Amado deconstructs Caesar's boast in a dazzling love letter he writes in Love's Labour's Lost. We lost, so what? Lord Barlow, one of those rebels against King Henry IV, who fails to overthrow him in the battle that ends Henry IV, Part 1, proposes in the first scene of the play's sequel that his gang should make another attempt. And this is what Shakespeare is really talking about for the occasion. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Right? So, now he wants to prep us. And how does he do it? This is just the ingenious part. You know, get ready. Let's roll it. So he doesn't talk about that or he doesn't get into, oh my goodness, my army's too small and we're exhausted and outnumbered. And yeah, we're just past the Battle of Culloden for all of those who care about such things. But we're a few of us, and we're a happy few, and we're a band of brothers. So King Henry moves on to the task of getting his men stoked and adrenalized and ready to charge. And here's, you know, how does he, what's that turning point? What's that tipping point? Being properly psyched, he says, all things are ready if our minds be so. And Shakespeare repeats this in Hamlet. He says, the readiness is all. And he does it again in Hamlet when Gloucester says, ripeness is all. There you go. Have at it. Have at it. So when you throw open the window or you're out for a walk and you feel the wind against your face and you notice it blowing the branches or the dust devils at your feet, I want you to think about the sound of masonry that echoes those voices, however gentle, the whisper, were picked up by the winds. So where our constitutions have been struggling is in trying to capture the wind, trying to say there's only a boy wind, there's no girl winds, there's no winds over in that part of the, there's, you know, it's like masonry adapts, doesn't it, to the notion the winds carry those voices all over the face of the globe and out into the universe, as far as the winds can go. And the impact and have influence, sure. So listen for it. It's there. It's there. It's always there. But you have to listen for it. One of the great big secrets, don't you think? Here, thank you very much. And for the fact that Masonic Effects is having an audience in different places of the world, send me a note, masoniceffects@gmail.com. We'll tell me what you like, tell me what you need, we'll get on with it. It's an absolute pleasure. This is Le Petit Déjeuner Parisien de la Musique Lounge. Très chic, c'est là. Get into it, gentlemen.
Le Petit Déjeuner Parisien, la Musique Lounge.
I'm going there.
Yeah. Christiane Robillard.
See you soon.
Mon Dieu, que c'est triste, il m'aimait si peu. Moi, je l'aimais tant, je crois. Mon Dieu, tu t'en fiches, toi, tu n'as Dieu que pour une autre que moi. Même si le temps passe, je n'oublie pas. La samba, la samba des jours avec toi. La samba des jours.
Bye. Thank you. Thank you.